because I eat tons of cake.
cake and weights. That's a good combo. My diet's
not very good, but to be honest, I've cut everything else out. I don't smoke, don't do quite a lot of things, but yeah. Diet's the last vice that I should probably set about.
I think diet's important, but if your exercise is like super intensive, then apparently that's going to help. So I saw some reports, sumo wrestlers, obviously they're massively, ridiculously fat, right? And they're way, way overweight. It looks terrible. But you do an MRI scan on a sumo wrestler, and apparently all of their body fat is subcutaneous. So in other words, it's not visceral, even though it looks like if someone who's body shaped like that doesn't do sumo wrestling, that's visceral fat on the organs. It's bad news. Sumo wrestlers, because they exercise so much, but they eat even more.
Yeah.
All of it's subcutaneous. In other words, underneath the skin. So actually they're very, very fit underneath all of that excess weight.
That's me, I think. I think I'm that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to help, man. You're a sumo wrestler.
I mean, if you think about, sometimes you look at front row rugby players and you go, wow, it's like a throwback to the 1990s. You're not built like an athlete. However, they absolutely are. And they've got the right shape for the position they play.
You know what? And that's true for anybody that does like daily intensive exercise. They're strong, strong people, like agricultural people or builders, construction workers, all this type of stuff. Mate, they're properly rock hard. Because they got all this functional strength, even though they may look like, oh my goodness, this is not body beautiful, but they're gonna be decent athletes underneath the aesthetics.
Andy Ruiz Jr.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he like the second AJ fight, yeah, no, he let it go too much. But the first AJ fight, he came in, he didn't look like ripped or anything like that. But I can tell you what, he was fit. He was fit as hell, even though he didn't look it.
Do you know it's genetic? Have you seen, if you go onto YouTube or TikTok, look for Andy Ruiz's brother sparring, and no disrespect, but Andy Ruiz's brother is genuinely obese. He's like well over, but his hands and his hand speed, him and the speed bag, it's like, oh my goodness, this guy is like, he's handy.
Don't mess
ass
with that guy. No,
yeah, he's handy ass. Anyway, we'll talk about obese boxers at another time, Adam, because we are talking Brain Food Live. Welcome everybody to Brain Food Live. It's episode 134. We're bringing it to you every Friday. We've only got about four of these left to the end of the year, so I hope you're still enjoying the show with us. Welcome everybody to the show. Okay, we always kick off with a bit of sound checking just to make sure that we're okay on these multiple channels we're broadcasting to. So for the folks who are on Crowdcast, I think there's something like 75 of you there. If you can hear me okay, just give me some indication on the chat stream. You can hear me fine. We are live on LinkedIn Live as well. So for my diminishing number of followers on LinkedIn, if you're still watching this on LinkedIn, let me know. Give me an indication somehow that you can hear me okay. We completely failed to broadcast this on Facebook last week. I think I failed again. There's obviously some widget I failed to push. So if you can hear me on there, let me know. If not, then fine, I'll fix it another time. And I do believe we're punching this out on Twitter as well, which is a bonus. I at least Crowdcast can hear us, which is fine. And I can see LinkedIn hearing us as well. Thank you, Theo. Appreciate it. So we're all good. Let's a quick word to our sponsors before we kick off, as we always do. Totally appropriate for the show today. Our sponsors are Guide.com. These are the business that have, there's certain companies that use Guide and they rave over it. And I need to take a deeper look as to what they do. But essentially, they purport to be able to personalize the candidate experience, even at scale. So I think that is the promised land that we need to get to. We want to do things efficiently and make sure no one is ignored in the process. But how do you do that if you got tens of thousands of people coming through the flow? Well, apparently Guide have the technology to do that. So I think they're part of the gym group now, but definitely check out guy.co if you care about candidate experience. They seem to be a super exciting business. I think there's a free trial on there, at least a demo. So go ahead and check them out if this is a topic of interest. Okay, welcome to Adam Gordon. Adam, how are you doing? Good to see you. Well, I say good to see you, but obviously the Movember is tough on all of us, really, isn't it? To have to look at this.
I'm getting used to it.
Don't.
I'm getting used to it. I might just keep it forever.
Thing is, though, you start to cheat because all of the chin hair is coming. That's just like regrowing a beard again, isn't it? So that's not the same as the Movember deal. So
I ran out of time. That's that like Nike tick down here is still there. I ran out of time to
shape it
really
properly.
Accentuate it by shaving properly. But
yeah.
Next week I've got something very special for you. It's everything's changing on my face.
Like what can you do?
No, it's a surprise. I'll just leave it at that.
All right. As long as it's not like some horror shit, so massive cosmetic surgery.
I've had a nose job.
No. Yeah, no, man. Let me know if you're gonna inflict that onto the audience.
No, it's Movember, Movember related.
Movember related. Okay, cool. Well, listen, mate, let's get into the show. Let's talk about the newsletter of last week. Did you read it? And if so, what was particularly interesting, man?
Yeah, I did read it. Let's start off with the 12 competencies.
Oh, the recruiter competencies.
Yeah, 12 competencies for a recruiter as detected by LinkedIn. The functional competencies, I thought were pretty straightforward. Things like, you need to be good at sourcing, you need to be good at assessment, you need to be good at different things like that. It was actually three of these competencies were foundational, as in like in your DNA, have you got these things? And if you do, then that could set you up for being a good recruiter. And the other stuff can be learned. But the three foundational competencies were the ability to embrace evolution, a natural curiosity, and the ability to be agile. And like, if you've got those three things, you could be a really good recruiter. I think that was my takeaway from that, more so than the functional things. They can all be learned. But if you've got those three things, then I absolutely agree. If you lack any of those things, then you are unlikely to be good at recruitment. There's just too many things happening all the time. It changes all the time. Things get cancelled. Things get started. You're not whatever you think you're going to be doing when you get up in the morning, whatever you think you're going to be doing that day, don't think that will actually happen. Because everything will change throughout the day, every day. So really good article. For anybody, any of your friends or whatever, like they're thinking about becoming a recruiter, go and read that first. If they've got those things, they could be good.
That's really good advice. It might actually be useful to try and share that link, folks, because everyone's complaining about, look, there's not enough recruiters out there. Well, okay, we need to maybe persuade some people to do the job. So that kind of list of 12 things, I've got to say, I don't agree with all of them, but I like the fact that they talked specifically about I have the opposite view of you. I have less interest in the foundational, but more interest in actually the work, because it breaks down, okay, you need to identify, you need to find people, right? That's the number one thing. That is something you should know. Share that around, people. I think it's from 12 months ago. It's not a new thing, but I just came across it. I thought, okay, first time I've seen anybody, it's the first time I saw the article. In which case, let's talk about this, because we need to get new talent into the industry rather than just like waiting for people with 3 years experience suddenly to announce their availability and be interested in our jobs,
The only thing about it is I do think it probably the other nine, which are like, here's the things you need to be good at to be a good recruiter. I do think that they relate to maybe a sort of entry level kind of recruiter. It's like 360 degree stuff. Like, you've got to be great with data. You've got to be, but you've got to be able to achieve influence as well. And, some of these are slightly like, it describes the 360 degree recruiter, which is becoming
right
a bit more passe today, and a sophisticated recruitment team. You're not going to be doing all those things.
Right.
I think you're right. That's something else to bear in mind.
Yeah, I think you're right. Maybe that is where it looks a little bit dated, because it was from 2020, I think, which, you know, might be another aeon ago as far as we're concerned.
A long time ago.
It is. But I had that challenge as well when I asked the question, how long does it take to train a recruiter? And there is a maturation of the job. There's different things to get to up and running compared to being fully competent, and that's a journey that we're on. So but yeah, check it out. Very good. Okay, give us another.
Unilever have got an amazing internal mobility program which allows people to try out different jobs to find out what's it like to work in data analysis, what's it like to work in finance. And everybody has the opportunity to sign up for this. And you've got to go through a process to get it approved and whatever. You can't just go, right, today I'm going to be the CEO. It's a little bit more restrictive than that. However, I wonder whether it's only like, you know, FTSE 100 big global businesses that can create this type of approach. We need to be much more flexible about the talent we have in the organization and how we deploy them. Or else we're going to have massive problems with being able to hire, because the days of going, I need somebody to do this, here's the 12 things they must have, they are dwindling.
Right.
If we can get people internally and they've got 9 of those 12, then we need to be much better at internal mobility. And Unilever's program is probably the best I've seen. So that's worth reading.
Yeah, you know what? They're clever, Unilever, because I think that not only clever, because they do pretty much a lot of recruitment innovation, but I think they do a lot of recruitment innovation with an eye to get into the Business Insider and to create the case studies and then to say, oh, wow. And then they're up in the lights again. So I think there's a really smart marketing thing as well associated with what they do. But it does tell me that they prioritize the hiring and the cultural aspect of the business as a key component as to how they grow their company. The example, I think, is very exciting. I think you're right. It's probably a scale thing. Like, the bigger the business you are, the more potential value an internal mobility program of this type is going to have. Because the bigger you are, the bigger the chances are you're going to miss the talent. So definitely check it out. It's an inspirational story. It's all about talent management. Anybody who's like keeping an eye on what recruiters have got to care about, internal mobility is something we need to basically own. Because if we're only externally facing, then guess what? I think the scope will shrink and our jobs will shrink with that. So bear in mind all of these things as you think about the things that you need to do for your own business. Okay,
one thing just quickly. You said earlier, you know, they're very clever in terms of the ways that they go about doing some of these things. I do wonder though if actually it is clever or whether it's absolute necessity. It's like table stakes. A company of that size, they have to do stuff like this, or else they'll start like just to maintain the status quo, or else they'll start going backwards. So things like this may not even be about performance enhancement. They might just be about being like staying still.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right to give a rebuttal there, because my assessment of them, you know, having a marketing hat on may be ungenerous. You're quite right. It could well be that this is something that they must do, given the scale and size of their company. If you're like, I don't know who it is who's in charge of these projects or whose responsibility it is, but if you're brought in to that type of job, it's got to be one of the biggest jobs on the planet in terms of the work we do. You're not going to be a business as usual type, are you? You're not going to say, oh, sit here and tick it over. You're going to have to go and do spectacular projects like this. Give us one more, mate.
Facebook, Francis, is it Haugen?
Yes.
The data, she was a data engineer who leaked tens of thousands of documents, I think it was. So I read the article, which was about like shock inside Facebook. You know, recruiting leaders are going, we've got a problem, supply and demand problem. And unfortunately, you need to suck it up and put your seatbelt on. And I read the article thinking, yeah, for us in recruitment, this is like, so what? There's nothing new in this. Everybody knows. Like, it doesn't matter how glamorous or well-known your organization is. Nobody is finding recruitment as easy as they were in 2019. Right. So unless they were a 20-person business then, and now they're like some sort of unicorn, which is a few, but almost nobody is finding it as easy as they were. The bit that was actually the most interesting bit links to employer brand for me, and that is the horror that she expressed when she was told that Facebook are hiring 10,000 engineers in Europe to work on like metaverse type stuff.
Yep.
And other things, rather than hiring 10,000 people to work on making their members safe and secure and all that type of thing. Now, of course, there's a lot of different ways of looking at that, but this does create a big employer brand challenge for a company that is so public as Facebook. I really love Facebook as a company overall. However, you know, working in TA there must be really fascinating.
It is. I think it's a fascinating job. And in fact, I'm going to be speaking to a few recruiters from Meta in a couple of weeks, not related to what they do with Facebook, but related to another topic. But it is fascinating. It is one of the most dominating businesses we've seen and a very significant player. How they do employer branding there is going to be very interesting. We've had that debate, not on our show, but online. We've seen, you know, our friends like Amy and Ivan have chats online about this. Like, is it easier to hire if you've got one of the big, big, big tech names? And the answer is yes, it is at a certain point, but there's also other challenges involved that are unique to you as well. So those things, I think, are very, very interesting to explore. Definitely an EB issue. Talent attraction is probably not the hardest thing. You're going to get things through the pipeline. But I can imagine if you're going outbound and interacting with so-called, you know, the top people in industry, people might think, okay, do I really want to work for a business that, you know, if you look at where the wind is blowing, maybe it's not blowing in that direction. You know, these very elite individuals that have these like top market skills, I can imagine it'd be quite hard to persuade them maybe to go to someone like Facebook at this point.
I'm going to say something that sounds, it might sound a little bit, everybody else might have already appreciated this, but if we link it back to one of the stories we talked about last week, which was, I can't remember her first name, but her surname was Lee, and she put together two versions of her CV, applied for the jobs. The version of her CV that had like Microsoft and, you know, Apple and stuff like that on it, you know, she got loads more interviews. For early career engineers, having something like Facebook on your CV is going to be a massive career boost. And it's Absolutely. Probably almost a mandatory. If you're really ambitious for your career, you really need that. It's like being an accountant and having PwC on your CV.
Right.
It's something that's going to be really quite important. But as people become more... as people start to develop more Angelina, that's it. As they develop more experience of not just their career, but the world, they may go, yeah, do I want to work for a company that aggregates information on the internet? Or do I want to work for a company that's solving world hunger? You know, so I think getting that so therefore my point is maybe at that early first, second job phase, companies like Facebook and Apple and Microsoft, they can go and like reign supreme in that area. I wonder if the challenges for them maybe are in the more experienced engineering hires.
That's actually a really interesting topic. And in fact, we should do a Brain Food Live on that. Like how your employer brand isn't evenly effective across different sort of the maturation of the candidate. Is that true or not, folks? Let me know. Yeah. Does it make more sense? Are you basically as a candidate less sensitive to the brand power of the employer as you get older? I think you probably might be, because you might have built enough network value yourself to have the confidence to say, you know what, I don't need to get into that company because I've already got 10 years in my experience doing this, this, and this. You may have already got one of those companies in your locker, and you're confident in your market value as a result, so you're not under that pressure. But if you're young in your career, your first job, I think, probably is quite important. Yeah. Because your second job, is going to be the person recruiting your second job is going to be looking at your first job. That's all they've got to go on.
Yeah.
And if it's a no-name brand in the middle of nowhere, that's not saying that's a bad company, but it means that the recruiter will have to do extra work to figure out how good you are. And that's extra barrier to entry, isn't it?
So,
interesting one, folks. Let me know what you think. I mean, employer branding, is that actually a lens we need to actually put on to think, okay, our brand is like this and it really optimally attracts people who've got 5 years plus experience, but it's probably not as good for first jobbers, second jobbers, that kind of thing. And how does that then play out in terms of your approach?
If you wanted to do something with that, the people that would be really interesting to include in it outside of tech would be the people at the likes of PwC and EY, because, you know, I spent 3 years at PwC, and if I think about people leaving university, if they want to be an accountant, they want to be CFO in the future in some company, they probably need to have one of the big four on their CV at the beginning of their career. However, like 10 years in, I mean, I can hear people saying this, like 10 years in, no, I wouldn't want to work in a sweatshop like that. You know,
mate,
totally different kind of experience, totally different thinking.
You've just, it'd be interesting study to do. Like, how many CFOs in the FTSE 100 have actually started in one of these big four accountancy firms?
We already know that. It is nearly all of them. Yeah,
there's 100%.
It's not 100%, but it's like certainly 80%.
Yeah, it's almost like Eton, isn't it? To be a prime minister, you have to have gone to Eton. It's a fact. It's near as damn it a fact. In terms of like it's a public school, one public school, have to go to it. Otherwise, you ain't got the network value to actually become the prime minister of the country. So the entire idea that we live in a meritocracy is obviously a fiction. But that is probably something that applies to things like the accountancy level. There's certain elite firms that basically almost operate, I wouldn't say as a cartel, but they definitely like circulate between each other, don't they? So, you know, if you're going to leave PwC and you don't go into industry, but you stay in accountancy as a consultant or whatever, it's going to be Deloitte or it's going to be EY. It's going to be one of those.
Yeah. This is not even CFOs, by the way, because the number one profession for FTSE 100 CEOs is accountant. 52%, I think it is, of 52 of the FTSE 100 CEOs are accountants. Therefore, it's something like, 30 to 40 of them that are big four trained, backgrounds. So it's at the CEO level.
That's amazing. And it's amazing power as well. Like if you're in one, I mean, it compounds also. So it makes even more sense for you to get into one of those companies so you can join the alumni network, so you can build all of that stuff and almost have that, cocktail bar cachet when someone, you're from there, or I used to be there. You know, that kind of sense of identity and tribalism is going to apply in those social circumstances, isn't it?
So, and it'll be the same in tech. It'll be becoming the same in tech. If I'm getting 500, applications for a job, I'm getting 100 applications for a job. I'm going Microsoft, yes. Facebook, yes. Never heard of you. Need more work to look at it. Don't know. I'm putting it there, and before I know it, I've got 10 people on here on this side already. That's enough. I don't need to look any further.
That's it. And yeah, Andrew, Susan, absolutely. This is bias. This is locked in privilege. And it's basically about kind of, elite protecting elites. That's how it works. And it's very interesting to see how we deal with it and how we cope. And maybe we as recruiters have a role to play. I don't know. But it's we're equally part of the problem in the sense that, as you say, if you see candidates with these high profile names on their backgrounds, you're not going to be prejudiced against them. More so, you're going to think, actually, I'm a bit relieved because I'm going to put these forward to my hiring manager, and my hiring manager is going to feel at least I've done some quality control on it. You know what I mean? So we're all kind of susceptible to it, and we're all kind of feeding into the machine a little bit. Anyway, we're diving off into a topic maybe we should discuss. But today we're talking about candidate journeys. And in particular, what is a candidate journey? Are we mapping it out? What does a good one look like? What does a bad one look like? And what does an egregiously ugly one look like? When people complain, I think one of the things I want to try and get out of this show is that, you know, if you go online, anywhere you go, you're going to see people complaining about what horrible candidate experience they've had. But oftentimes the candidate themselves don't have the framework to understand why it's bad. They just feel, oh, this is terrible. And they can give like a kind of a personal account, personal experience as to why they've not been treated in the way they think they've been treated. But is there a way where we can abstract that a little bit and figure out, okay, this is the general reason why this happens. This is why it's bad and how we can fix it. So we're going to bring in some guests here to talk about it. Because yes, Adam, you and I don't know anything about it. In which case, you probably do, to be fair, but I certainly don't. So let's bring in people who do. I'm excited today because we've got some all-time friends that actually have been guests of ours for a long time. We want to be guests all the long time. We've never found the time to bring them on, but now we're going to try and do it. So let's see whether we can get these good folks into the show, and we'll have a great chat. For the folks who are watching us, we're waiting for the panel to join us. Candidate experience, do you have a unique tool to help you manage your candidate experience? Or is it something you have to kind of do yourself? Or is it part of a core system? What is it? Let me know in the comments. Okay, we have Tim Sanchez joining us. Tim, how are you doing?
Hey, everyone. This is amazing. I can't believe I made it here.
Great. Great to see you. In fact, everyone's here. We've got Susan as well, and we've also got Coase as well. Coase is in his bedroom. I mean, could you not find yourself a better place, man? You're meant to be an important person at a multinational company.
Sorry. Just an attic, you know? Guest bedroom, by the way.
No worries. That's all good. Okay, let's do some intros. Tim, you were on first. So would you like to quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, hey, everyone. Tim Sanchez. I lead global talent acquisition for a telco company based in Central and South America. We're about 24,000 employees. I've been with the organization 2 years. Super, super fan of TA. Pretty much a lot of what I do personally and professionally is related to talent acquisition. I'm a one-trick pony, I think. I just go so deep in talent acquisition. So I don't know the other worlds. I'm not an HR generalist. I don't know comp and ben. I don't know all those other things. But when it comes to TA, it's something that I really, really like. Prior to my world here at Millicom, I used to head talent acquisition for MasterCard in Latin America and the Caribbean. And then I worked for a bunch of other companies and agency side as well. So awesome Great. To be here. Thank you for the invite, Hum.
No worries. Great to have you on the show, Tim. And we've got Susan here as well. Susan, great to see you again. For the folks who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, and what it is you do?
Yeah, for sure. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are. I'm Susan Lamott. I'm the founder and CEO of Exaquio. We are an employer brands and employment experience firm based in Charleston, South Carolina, here in the U.S. And prior to running Exaquio, I was the global employer brand leader for Marriott International a decade ago. So great to see you all.
Amazing. Great to see you, Susan. Welcome back to the show. And Coase, how are you? Long time no see. And actually your debut on the show as well. So welcome. Who are you? What is you do?
So indeed, Brain Food Live newbie. So hi, I'm Coase Wurzer. I'm the Global Head of Employer Branding and Candidate Experience at Danone. So I actually have candidate experience in my kind of job title. And you might know Danone from the Danone yogurts, but we also have a huge waters division with big brands you might know like Evian water and specialized nutrition like Nutritia, baby food and advanced medical nutrition. So more than 100,000 employees. So one of these like huge firms you guys mentioned earlier today and which made it even more of a very interesting and challenging task and project to kind of try to track that, you know, kind of experience and everything around branding on a global level. So happy to be here and curious to learn also from these other people in the call. Good to see you too.
Great stuff. And by the way, folks, if you've got any questions for our panelists, please use the ask a question feature at the bottom of your screen. We're going to get to those questions at the end of the show. So feel free to keep chatting on the chat stream, but specific questions you definitely want to address, we're going to look at that sort of function at the end, and we'll get to them at that point. Okay, let's talk about this idea of candidate experience. Let's talk about overviews firstly. Since we last talked about a candidate experience, obviously we've had a number of things happening. We've kind of a slow shift back to the office. We've had some controversies about remote work. Are we going back? Are we not? There's all this kind of discussions happening in society. I'm sure that's affecting how we talk to candidates also, because they're obviously citizens in society as well. How does all of this like fit with our planning around candidate experience? Like, are we factoring in things like the mode of work that this person is going to be doing? And is that affecting how we shape the candidate journey for these people? To speak in more plainer English or plainer language, in other words, if the job were ambiguous, we don't know whether it's on site or not. It's like we currently are in this holding pattern. Does that change how we behave when we are designing the candidate experience for people who might be doing that job? Thoughts on this? Let's go, Tim, go to you. I mean, what have you been doing on that? Have you factored in, like, you know, lockdown, in and out, remote? Is that something you've been factoring into your candidate experience side?
We have. We really have. It's been hard because, of course, for everyone before this whole pandemic, no one, especially us, we never imagined we would go from being on site 5 days a week to completely going virtual and remote. So when this whole shift happened on D-Day, March 13th, that whole global shutdown, first course of action was just protect the people. But then afterwards, we started thinking, all right, now that people are protected, how are we gonna change the way we work? So we started looking at how we even started doing the recruiting. And then we started putting like a huge task force, and I have all the numbers and all that information about how we wanted to approach candidate journeys and candidate experience. And we started looking at it differently. We started saying people are coming in at different ways now. People want to work different ways, and people aren't going to work on site anymore. And completely different. We're a telco company. Telco a lot of times has legacy thinking. Very, you know, on-site, in-office, 9 to 5, 8 to 6 kind of environment. So it was a complete shift for us. So we had to gather a lot of people together to look at how are we going to change the way we work.
Does that mean it's got easier? I mean, without sort of denigrating anybody's job, right? But, you know, candidate experience, when there's people physically moving into our processes, that's like a lot of logistical stuff that we have to do. But one thing we've found about the shift to remote is actually a lot of the logistical weight has been shifted off the recruiting side. Does that kind of make it a little bit more efficient for us who are thinking about designing candidate journeys? Is it more easy to create a great journey given the fact this person may not need to come into any place? Any thoughts on that? Go to you on this, Coast.
Yeah, so I fully agree. I think I was in my first years at heading up TA for our global R&D center of Nutritia, our specialized nutrition brand. I mean, our R&D facilities in the Netherlands are just so beautiful. So I usually just say, you know, I just need to get the people in the building, and then my job is done, basically, you know. So and of course that's a large part of the candidate journey as well, right? Where am I going to be working? What's going to be, who are the colleagues, what's the smell of the place, what is, you know? And luckily, I think a couple of years prior, we really put a lot of effort in recreating the global career sites, adding in social wall, you know, making more and more of the candidate experience, of everything we see digitally, the digital journey of the candidate, really opening up the windows. Before, we had a like stock photography on danone.com and the jobs on jobs.danone.com, which was a really beautiful success factors job page. I think many of the people in the call know exactly what I'm talking about. So there was no real, you know, look into the company. And then, of course, entering the company, entering the great R&D facilities we had, it was like, okay, a world is opening up. And with the global career site and our local career sites we're rolling out, we're really enabling countries to give those views of offices, of locations, of people, real people, no stock photos and loose employer branding claims, but just real people, real talk, social wall. And here also, you see a very updated view. We give a very updated view on the people of Danone and what they're experiencing. So if you go to the social wall, Life at Danone on our career site, you'll see people with mouth caps on, you know, in the office, you know, working from home. And that's the kind of thing people, I think, want to see. Initially, in the end, you want the candidate you need to be able to envision themselves in the role, in the, you know, in the teams, in the company. And I think with building that ecosystem of a very transparency and authenticity, I hope that we're contributing to that journey.
That's great. I want to ask you about the social wall in a bit, because I think we know what we're talking about, but I'd love to have a bit more of a description on it. However, there is a bit of feedback I'm hearing from your side, Coach. So I wonder whether you could see whether maybe you could fix that a little bit. It seems that we can hear like two of your voices there, but have a fiddle around if you can. Let's go to you, Susan. Working as a consultant and delivering sort of EV services and this type of stuff to this customer base, what have you been seeing from a demand side? Have you been able to plot like different things that customers are starting to ask from you? And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think in the past, we've looked at candidate experience in such a tactical way, right? What can we do at each step? Let's implement these surveys. Let's give candidates the swag. What we're starting to see a lot more of is how can we think about it strategically? How do we want candidates to feel? What's the emotion that we want them to have? And then how do we prioritize which points in the journey these emotions matter? Because when we focus on the tactical piece, we tend to focus on kind of the bookends of the relationships. And what I mean by that is this notion of my experience or the relationship with the organization, right? So the swag might root me with the organization, or the, you know, particular experience I might have seeing content might root me into my job. But what people really are thinking about, I think, is how am I going to feel in this job? How will this job or this employment experience make me feel? And so in the candidate experience, we need to mirror that. And that's where the strategy comes into play. And that really, I think, connects to the two largely overlooked elements of what will my relationship with my peers be in this job? And what will my relationships with my managers be? And those elements are so overlooked in the candidate experience because we're so focused on, let's show them the office, let's get them some swag, let's talk about benefits and comp, and then let's look at the job, right? Let's pull up the rec. Let's see if you have any questions about the rec. We forget about the real meat of the job. So that's what we're seeing a lot more as people, especially going virtually. How do we talk more about these relationships that I'll have when I get in the organization?
You know what? That seems like a good motive, but half of it is through because companies no longer have the choice. As Coase mentioned, it's like in some respects, you've got to, in some respects, the investment in facilities is also the investment in candidate experience, right? It was like, oh, let's just have an amazing like office. And that, as you say, that's going to wow them. And then that's job done. That's cool. The experience is going to be great. And to a large degree, that was true. If you went to any of these big Silicon Valley businesses, amazing, amazing offices, it's like, yeah, I want to be here. It's great. But suddenly you lose that as an asset, as an employer, you don't have that as an asset anymore. You have to apply your energies and elsewhere. And you've identified two things that companies seem to have elevated their understanding on, which is key relationships, right? Key relationships this person will be having in the office, sort of in the work if they get the job. And this is the peers that they'll be dealing with, and obviously the relationship with hiring managers. You know, we talked about, I don't know whether you guys saw the show, but there was something about employee-generated content. We did a show with the IBM global team a couple of weeks ago about this. That has got to play a big part in this relationship building side. I wonder whether you could tell us a little bit about any experimentations you've done in your companies about EGC. Like, how have you done this and has it been a success? Tim, go back to you on this.
Oh, so we're early in that. Actually, right now we just started working on getting waivers for employees to do that. So we're getting employee waivers and we're saying, hey, we want to include you here. We're redesigning, revamping our candidate, our careers page. But we want to be inclusive and we want to include everyone from different operations, different levels, but we have to get waivers. So we actually started working with our legal and compliance to start getting the waivers, to get it organized. That's exactly what we're going to do. So we're early in that journey, but that's exactly where we're going. That's what we need to do. We wanted to move away from the stock pictures that people mentioned.
Let me interrupt just real quick. Please document the journey for us. Think this would be totally fascinating to see where you're going. I mean, obviously you're a busy man, you've got other stuff to do, but if there's some way in which we could track where you're at, that would be amazing because that journey, oftentimes when we hear case studies, it's like, oh, the completed thing. And then you get the Unilever story and all this type of stuff. It's like, obviously amazing. However, that's after X amount of work, because we want to see how the sausage is made, right? And you're right now, the pigs are still running around in the farm. So this will be a perfect timing to see whether we can actually track the journey through. That would be marvelous to see. Let me know if you think that's a good idea, folks. I you know, to be able to get a little bit of a window as to Tim's thinking and his implementation of this, it would be, I personally think it would be very, very exciting. Okay, I interrupted you, man. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, but I can absolutely do that. So when we were designing all this and we went through this, we put a beautiful little, you know how everyone puts beautiful PowerPoints together? So we put that beautiful PowerPoint together and say, hey, we need to sell this. Because when we needed to sell this, we were involving a lot of company resources to do this. We did this in-house. It was, to be exact, it was around 19 people dedicated 50% of their time across operations, across levels. And to dedicate that much of your effort on a beautiful design was a big ask. So when we did it, we did the buy-in, which what we called, I guess it was step one. Then we did the kickoff, which was back in June. We started working on it, but everything's been delayed. Just so you know, all these dates, they're delayed. So by the time actually things started kicking off. So right now we're in what I call like phase three, which is where we're delivering. So what I mentioned right now about moving away from stock photography to real photography, that's something we identified in the journey. That we said we needed to be more authentic and more real about what people are experiencing working at Beagle, working at Millicom. Because we have a great brand, so we want to be very clear about what's it like to work here. So pictures is one, videos is one, but it's all a lot of work and we do a lot of things internal. So I'm in step three and right now, and then the step four is, I guess, when we stabilize this whole journey. But I can talk more about it. I have the PowerPoints. I have all the mapping of it. I have all the design. I have it all. And I know that we weren't supposed to prep and show things, but I think Susan was ahead of the curve. She even shared something earlier before our call.
Hey, listen, if you put like 19 people's effort into a PowerPoint, I think everyone needs to see it, right? It's like, yeah. don't hide that anywhere. Let's get that out there. Okay, I think this is the operational side is very interesting. Like, how do you even get the buy-in? I think that's also something we should explore. But let's focus to the candidate side for a moment. How did you pick up the information that candidates wanted this? Like a lot of it we've got is basically good sense, you know, things that make sense. But is there any way in which you pulled out the information from the candidate side that you makes you confident that your intuition is actually backed by what the desire is?
Back to me?
Yeah, Tim.
Yeah. So the closest that we could do was going to the recruiting team. So we started involving recruiters from different operations, and we have different levels of recruiters. We have some recruiters that are focused on the front line, the high volume recruiting. We have recruiters that are more senior, so they'll focus on like leadership roles, and then we'll have recruiters on the team focus on the, you know, on the bulk, the professional recruiting. So we included them, and what we did was, I took like these little rough notes because I wasn't going to present everything, but we included them and we said, hey folks, let's talk about what are the moments that a candidate will feel throughout the journey. And then we divided the journey into join, develop. We called it request, like all the support and retire. But we said, what are the moments that a candidate feels? As a recruiter, we're very much aware. And then I think it was Susan that mentioned that on the call, we started linking it to emotions. So to be very clear, when a candidate receives a notice saying, hey, you're not selected for this role, we used a frowny emoji. Right. So we were very clear with these little emojis saying what a candidate would experience would be that. But then we put another moment saying by receiving this, they actually probably felt, you know, maybe neutral because at least they got some sort of feedback. Right. And so we started mapping it like that. And the way we were able to do this, and you mentioned it too, Hung, about getting the buy-in. We did this with our customer journeys. We have a business transformation office. They did this for the customer journeys before. They did this work and they said, we need to bring this into recruiting. Recruiting is one of like our key global objectives of improving. So they're the ones that helped us do this. It wasn't me magically having the power to do things. I had a lot of support with these folks where they were saying, we need to do this for our talent. That's we need amazing. To map it out just so how the way we did it for the candidate, for the customers. We're very customer focused.
Well, I think when you deal, you know, with customers, if you've got a really smooth, not smooth or complete, but you know, you've got some expertise there, it makes sense to see whether you can adapt some of those ideas and those frameworks into the candidate side. By the way, I love the idea of really being conscious about the emotional the expected emotion of these points that you're making. I think back in my day, you would not even think like that. You may implicitly know that a rejection is negative, but let's put an emoji there so the person knows it, so that when you see that screen to say, oh, we're going to send a lot of sad faces, you know what, you got to do something about that. You can't just leave people with the sad face. This is really good. Let's talk about the emotional side. Go to you, Susan, on this. You mentioned really early on that, you know, the feeling was a big part of this. How do you, do you forensically separate out these feelings in that way? And what do you do when there is a negative feeling? Like, you know that you're going to create a negative moment in the candidate's journey. Obviously, when they are rejected for a job, it's usually super the low point. What are the options an employer can do to ameliorate the feeling there?
I think first it's figuring out what does that actual experience look like across the board. So you're not looking at individual moments in time and reacting to them, but rather mapping your strategy from the time someone is even aware that your organization exists, all the way through to what we call belonging, which is the official moment or point in time when a candidate becomes an employee. Research tells us that's when they actually make a contribution to the job or the workplace. So as far as the negative moments or the challenging moments, they happen across the entirety of the experience. It's not just rejection. So part of it is staying true to what is your overall strategy, right? So we have levels that we use from subpar to captivate to determine what are the key moments that matter when we audit a candidate experience or the candidate journey, so we can understand which moments are most important. And then you can determine, you know, at the end of the day, rejection is always challenging. But do you want to be subpar and just reject someone, send them a message from a bot email, right? That is a subpar experience. Or do you want to captivate them? Do you want to say, Tim, I'm really sorry, I'm giving you this direct phone call. I know you really wanted this job and we really enjoyed getting to know you. As it turns out, there's someone who we have selected for the role that we think will be the most successful and really thrive in this role. That said, how can we help you? What are the steps we can partner with you on, or how can we hold your hand as you move forward and give you relationships, connections, et cetera? The challenge is you can't do that when you're mass hiring, right? So for your evergreen recs or high volume, you can't captivate at that level. So you have to figure out from your recruiting strategy across the board, where does it make sense to do that with candidates that might be your silver medalist candidates or those who you know are influential in the talent community, is where those in, you know, where future candidates may be. So that's why it's hard to just react with, you know, here's a strategy for this or here's a tactic for that. And it's why we tell everyone, start with research, start with thinking about how, what is your current experience now? How strong is that experience at every step of the journey? And then prioritize so that you're not trying to be all things to all people. Because at the end of the day, we don't have the resources to do it all for our high volume candidates, even though we'd love to do that. It's a really hard and expensive thing to do.
That's a really important point, Susan, because oftentimes, again, we talk about best practice or things that we'd ideally like to do, this aspirational sort of solutioning. But of course, we've all got constraints and constraints in terms of resources. Like, how do you handle it? And you need to prioritize and maybe even differentiate the sort of approach you have, the different populations or even different individuals, depending on the potential impact, I guess, in terms of, you know, that they can do. Coast, let's go to you on this, because as a person that's involved in such a large company, right, that must be the case, isn't it? Like, you can't give like the same universally amazing experience to every candidate. Do you have a kind of a way to chop that group up?
Well, I mean, you can't. Like, by default, you can't. Like, when you're getting in so many applicants, and it's also, you know, it's also you have a group of people fit for the role, you know, and they're considered, looked at, and everything. But you also have a group of people that are just applying to everything. Doesn't matter how, you know, without any sense of reality, let's say. The way that I've tried to cut it up is to measure the candidate experience. And I like the way that Susan mentioned it. It's like from the very beginning until onboarding and even offboarding. So it's this full journey in a holistic way. And what we are trying to do is, of course, with our branding and our career sites and opening up the windows and making it completely, you know, authentic and open. But of course, then you get to the stage where people apply, right? And then, you know, you see, and we're measuring the candidate experience for all candidates, rejected, hired. And we are doing that on a global level now for a few years. And of course, there's only so much you can ask a candidate after, and people are getting survey tired, you know, that's also the thing. And also, so what we've been measuring it, we've been tracking it. Of course, your data around the candidate experience is completely useless when you are targeting and you're asking your hired candidates. It's not going to come to a shocker that these guys are very, very happy just about on each step of the process. They're just happy campers. There's zero value on your recruitment processes from your hired candidates. So if you're in this call now and you're thinking, okay, let's start with our hired candidates and we do surveys on them, don't even try, because it's going to get you zero value. The real value is from your interviewed candidates and the candidates that you're actually engaged with. And we've been doing that. And you can only ask a candidate so much, especially when there's very little of engagement you've had. So if you're, you know, your CV, based on CV selection, you've been rejected. Okay, you cannot ask the world of a candidate. So what we've done is we put a tool in place, which is actually a couple of questions, very, you know, user-friendly, mobile-first and everything. And we enrich the data we get from the data we get from the candidate from the ATS. So we connect the two, and then we can see which country did they apply in, which job family, who was the recruiter involved, who was the hiring manager, when was the initial application done, and how much time was it until the application process ended. And with that, we created the dashboard which is super rich, where on a country level, talent directors can actually, you know, on a recruiter individual level, see who is giving a top-notch performance, who is struggling. And, you know, if you're struggling in the experience, doesn't mean that you're a bad recruiter. Could be that you're just managing two workloads at the same time, right? So it gives a quantitative look into...
I'd love to see this dashboard, Coase, but I guess you need to redact it in some way and make sure people's names are obscured. But at some time, that sounds like an amazing tool to have as a manager of this, to be able to monitor country level, team level.
But what makes it even more impactful is that when you're talking about, you know, 60,000-70,000 applicants, you can kind of track back the correlation level of each subsection of the process. So you can see, okay, this part of the process, if this is low, it usually has a low, then the overall experience is low. So you can actually track back where are we doing a good job, where are we doing a bad job, but also if we tackle certain subsections of the process, which is having a higher impact on the overall candidate experience. And with that, we have correlation numbers where we can see, you know, if for instance, the interview feedback and the role of the hiring manager are two parts which are hugely correlating with the overall happiness of a candidate. So we can say to a country, let's say US, hey, your hiring managers are not performing. And we can see that has a high impact in your local market. If you put up a certain program for this, educate your hiring managers, you're going to have significant impact on your overall happiness.
This is actually really interesting. And I want to ask you one more thing before, because we don't want to like have you give us a total case study here, but maybe we should have done. But can you give us some indication of an implementation you made on the back of this data that did have a significant and correlated effect? In other words, you saw a problem from this dashboard, said, all right, we're going to fix this, and then the thing changed. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, I mean, I'm in the global team, right? In the center of expertise. So we're putting up these kind of tooling. We are at the same time, I'm doing global deployment of 17 regional sites and all this. So I'm putting it in place, but it's up into the hands of the talent managers and the leaders in the countries to make it work. You know, so we are doing onboarding calls with them. We are, you know, doing the measurement. We show them how it's done. But we are very decentralized in that sense. So we give them the keys to the car, and they are the ones driving it. But from a data perspective, this is the insights that we bring to the table based on kind of measuring it on a global level.
That's amazing. And you know what? It's obviously Danone is a huge company, but companies of similar size probably don't have a function that provides this sort of service to the recruiting teams. But I think how useful would that be if you were like a recruiter and you had access to this data? It would be fantastic. Okay, let's go now.
Can I talk about, I'd like to talk about something that's going to add a bit more sophistication to this conversation, and that's around personalization. So personalization at scale is really the holy grail of experience in any way. You've got messages and information coming to you at the right time, in the right channels, with the right content formats, at the time you need it. Your brain goes, right, I wonder about that. Oh, hold on, it's right in front of my face because they've just sent it to me because they know what I'm thinking. It's quite difficult to achieve, and I'm interested to know how you have all adapted to the way that people want a much more personalized experience.
I'm happy to jump in here, Hung, just because for two reasons. One, so I had the privilege of earlier in my career running day-to-day talent acquisition for the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. And what I've seen over the past 20 plus years of working in TA is that we are so focused on technology, we want to automate everything. And when you automate things, you use personalization, you lose the personalization and the direct touch with that particular candidate. So as much as it's cheaper, it's faster, it's easier for us to do, you lose that connection. Ritz-Carlton built a brand based on empowering people to make the personal connections, make the choices individually, no matter what role they're in, from housekeeper to executive, to satisfy and anticipate the needs of the guest. If you apply that same level of thinking to the candidate journey or candidate experience, that's where you get, as Adam says, that high level of personalization. It's not going to come. And we have no alliances with any tech vendors. I love technology, but it is not going to come from adding something else to your tech stack. It's going to come from enabling and empowering every person in the journey from creating a meaningful experience. And I remind people every day, many of us are privileged and lucky that we're not living paycheck to paycheck, but our work puts food on our table and a roof over our heads. And when we automate everything, when a bot is responding to me, and I think that's going to create this level of personalization, I'm forgetting that I'm actually helping someone feed their family. I get really, really passionate about this because I think it's so important. And we have such a responsibility to remind our communities of this every day in our jobs.
All right. I think basically to summarize the point there, Susan, this may, because a little bit of a problem we have in recruiting and in business in general is that we optimize for profit all the time, right? So if we're going to do that, that typically means we're cutting costs, and that means not hiring people or getting more effort or more productivity from the people we have, which ultimately does mean additional tooling and automation. So what you're saying is actually what we should do is maybe like hire more. We need more people dealing with candidates, in other words. We need more like hands on deck. Even if it looks like from on a spreadsheet, it may look like, oh, this is over capacity. But in fact, maybe it isn't. Because if you're handling X amount of candidates, you can probably count the number of times you can give a decent service to those candidates.
I would say, Hung, though, I don't think it's necessarily about hiring more people. It's training the people you have to not make it routine. Look, I started my career as a recruiter. And when you're on your 27th phone screen of the day, that can feel really rote, right? You're just picking up the phone. Hi, it's Susan from Arthur Anderson. I'm calling to talk to you about this job. That was my very first recruiting job. That can make it feel very routine. So forget about adding more headcount. It's more about who are all the people that interact. And so much of it is not forgetting the role hiring managers play and empowering them to personalize, not just sending them the same interview prep form, but really researching like we do with, in sales, right? Who is this individual? And what do we know about them? And how can we personally connect with them? Really hard to do at scale. But think about the millions that organizations, and I see it all the time, are investing in their tech stack. Imagine if they diverted a portion of that to just training hiring managers to bring that emotional intelligence back into recruiting.
Well, it was actually a question into the stream there saying, how do we get hiring managers on board with this? And maybe that's something we'll need to handle at a different point. But I'm conscious of time, folks. So we're really flying through. But let's deal with the question Adam asked, and we'll go around, actually. It's an interesting one. So Susan's arguing for the case that actually hiring managers need to also contribute in a significant way on this, and we need to spend some time up-leveling them in order to help deliver this type of personal experience. Answer the question in your own way, though, guys. In terms of the personalization of scale, how do you do it? Is there something that can help you with this? Tim, do you want to give this one a shot?
I can tell you what I'm... I'm off mute. I can tell you what I'm thinking about doing. And I don't know if this is right or I don't know if it's going to work right now. But I've been thinking about... So we use something for assessing candidates. We have an assessment tech platform. And one of the things that we can pull from the assessments is we can pull like a candidate report, which gives very candidate specific things about where you're at, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if it's useful to give to candidates or send to candidates or how they're going to feel about receiving it that, hey, you weren't selected for this role, but this is what we saw. I don't know if, but it's my mind is thinking that because I do agree personalization is important. Early in my career, when I was an IT recruiter, I was known for getting back to people. I was known for giving people feedback, and it takes a crazy amount of time, more time than we can really imagine doing that. And to do that even at greater scale, not just at IT recruiting, I'm talking about the massive recruiting that we do. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how we can do
can
it.
Can I give you a bit of secondhand expertise? This is not my expertise, okay? Yeah. Anything that comes out that sounds like expert from me, it's not me, right? I got it from somebody else. But apparently if you're gonna give feedback, you wanna try and do that before a decision's made. So once the decision's made, it's concluded, yes, no, maybe, feedback then is colored because the person is going to be thinking, what is this? And it's hard to then think, oh, this person's purely rationalizing away or trying to make me feel better or whatever it is. So in other words, before you make the decision to reject, give the feedback then because you've already got the information.
Yeah, and maybe right? You make a good point. We could give it to them instantaneously. Hey, here's the reporting. We're going to use it now. We're going to start reviewing. And then maybe afterwards you could send some sort of notice about the selection process.
Yep, exactly. They're much more receptive that way. Okay, go to you with this code. Personalization at scale. Is there a way to do it? What's your approach? What are you thinking?
Well, at scale, we've tried to do it, and I think we mentioned the role of the hiring manager before, right? We need to, get away with the hiring manager saying, okay, it's up to the recruiter. Give me the good candidates, give me the best 2-3, and I'll hire one of them. What we've done, and I partially agree with Susan on headcount. Just adding headcount doesn't make sense, but expecting recruiters to run 60 vacancies at the same time and expect that kind of a red carpet treatment and everything, that's also dreaming. But what we try to do at Danone, we kind of acknowledge the role of the hiring manager as being super important, right? It's the person you're going to work for. People don't leave companies; they leave bosses and stuff like that. And embarking that hiring manager on, sitting next to the recruiter and doing the making it a joint effort in staffing for that particular team. We said, okay, make a selfie video where you answer 2-3 questions. Who are you? What's not in the job ad, but valuable for candidates to know? And what is life at Danone for this person? Linked to, of course, the employer branding campaign. We kind of have an external editor edit that into a very nice looking frame where it's like mocking a FaceTime call with your future boss. And we kind of hyper target that on LinkedIn, showcasing that into the competitors we want to target, the very niche group of people we want to see. And LinkedIn is just, asking us, like, how are you getting these kind of click-through rates and stuff like that, like 6 times more than regular promoted posts. But I think what's important here is that, you know, giving the visibility of the hiring manager towards the talent you want to recruit, and at the same time getting that engagement from the manager. Okay, it's our problem. It's not recruiter's problem. It's our problem, and we're doing anything possible, even video, putting that in hyper-targeting advertising mode on LinkedIn. We're really going all out. Gives a certain, you know, I'm being managed properly, and it's our problem, not your problem. It's something how we are trying to get that personalization through, which you cannot do for all jobs. Don't get me wrong. It's a lot of work too next to it, but by doing that at the very beginning, we are attracting better candidates at a higher pace, and you know it creates a higher manager satisfaction like we haven't seen before. So it definitely works to use that kind of engagement with your hiring managers.
You know, that's a really good answer. And Maury, yes, we will be speaking about video at some point. Folks, I nearly forgot, but we always try and do this every week. Don't let us stop this conversation. If you're interested in this topic about candidate journeys and how you make people feel as they go through that journey with you, please continue the conversation yourself. So take a moment and share your LinkedIn profile in the chat stream on your right and make sure you connect with everybody else on this call. This is true whether you're on Crowdcast or you're on LinkedIn or you're on Facebook or whatever. Take a moment. Everyone else who is watching this is also passionate about this topic, so it makes sense for all of us to find a way to talk to each other as we go through. Don't let our kind of timekeeping stop that conversation from continuing onwards. Adam, you asked the question. So these three folks, our amazing guests, have given their responses. Was it a rhetorical question? Like, do you have a solution? Or do you have some sort of idea that you think, okay, this is possible? Don't say you've invented a product. Like, okay, you know, what is the way to get personalization at some sort of scale?
Well, it depends on what we're talking about in terms of candidate journey, candidate experience, because We often think about it at the point of sale, and that's the point where the person's applying for the job and, you know, going through the interview process. And candidate journey and the relationship that a person builds with an organization, it starts at the point that they become aware of your brand. It doesn't start at the point that they apply for a job. And so I think up at that very top of the funnel, you can do when somebody's just starting to become aware and they're starting to learn a little bit, you can do vast amounts of personalization at scale using the right types of technologies. And we are using absolutely the wrong types of technologies in recruitment to try and do this. In mainstream marketing, they don't use the types of technologies that we use to go and nurture sales leads. They use different types of technologies. And it's very encouraging that we're seeing technologies that can deliver personalization at scale coming into our industry, but it's certainly not the ones that most large organizations are using. And one other thing I wanted to just mention was the application process is, I want to swear here, but I'm not going to use the words that are in my brain.
Do it, Adam,
somebody,
do it.
Somebody, it's fucked, like almost across the board. It is fucked.
Don't encourage him to use profanity, man.
Somebody in my immediate family has been applying for jobs recently, and if the career site is on either of two specific ATS platforms, she skips over and doesn't apply. She goes on a different company. And we're talking about global businesses that are losing candidates who are seeing the application process and the name of the ATS and going, I'm moving on to the next employer. That is despicable. Could you imagine trying to buy products and seeing and going, right, okay, I want to buy that car or something else like that, but actually their sign up process is terrible. So instead of that Volvo, I'm going to buy a Mercedes. I mean, come on, this is so, I know I said it's not all about the application process, and it's not. Starts at the beginning when they first find out about your brand, finishes when they retire, or maybe after that as well. But actually, like that bit, that really important bit it's so broken.
I think the reason why that's is broken as well, Adam, is that the mentality of the job seeker isn't always, I'm going to set aside particular time to apply for this job. Oftentimes you discover the opportunity whilst you're doing something else. It's like, oh, this looks interesting. And then you're in it. And then suddenly you're confronted with something that you thought was going to take 10 minutes, but in fact, it's an hour's worth of wrangling. You think, I don't have the time for this. Nope. And you don't have an easy way. Yeah, you move on or something else interrupts you and you forget about it and it's gone. I'd love to hear the abandon rate on ATS-driven sort of career sites. Like, that is a measurement vendors need to be monitoring, because I totally agree with you. A lot of them, you see what it is. You think, you know what, this is just going to be at least 10 minutes worth of misery. And the chances of me getting this job are low. So why am I even investing that time? So
mandatory account creation is 25% of your interested talent. Boof, gone.
Yeah. And yeah, absolutely.
I can tell you, I heard from Paradox the other day about, and this is absolutely true because I know the customer, because I also know them, the employer. They've got a 60% higher application rate when the person is applying through the chatbot than trying to do it using the forms. The information all ultimately goes into the same ATS, but doing it with the conversational AI turns into 60% more applications.
Yeah, I totally get it. And hopefully the UX and the UI will adapt to chat a little bit more. I mean, voice, I think, could be a way to apply in future. Go ahead, Coach.
Especially for companies like SuccessFactors, Taleo, this is a super complex and sophisticated connection and integration. Huh? It's not a, I know I was the first one who was always saying, oh, this, you know, the SuccessFactors apply form or whatnot, terrible. But, you know, we've been trying hard at Danone to get rid of it. We were successful for 1 week, then the integration broke. But there's a lot of techno sophistication there. And we are maybe switching ATSs. So when we made the decision to either stay with SuccessFactors or switch, then we do the integration on applications. But right now we also have the ClickOut. But it's such a sophisticated and complicated and also expensive integration. It's like hundred thousand maybe plus to get that integration done. If you're a company the size of us. So it is complicated, but I love new technologies popping up, like Adam is saying, with chatbots getting the kind of the same type of information. But my God, it's a project on its own, but it's one absolutely worthwhile in doing, because getting that integration done allows you to track all the way through to the higher candidate, and then you can match Google Analytics data and your ATS data, and then actually tell countries, if you post this job on this platform, this is where your successful candidates are. So it's worthwhile, but it's quite an endeavor.
I just want to say one other thing, which is I agree with Susan's point about more technology is not the answer. However, we are wholesale using the wrong technology. We're using CRMs as if they're marketing technologies when they're not. We're using the wrong things in the wrong places. And so I agree it's not about more technology, but we need to get better at using the right types of technology to do all of this.
Yeah. Okay. Susan, I'll put you on mute for a second because there's some background noise, but I'll get back to you in a second because we're coming to the end of the show. And I want all of you to think about, you know, one bit of advice you want to give to people who are thinking about needing to upgrade or up-level their candidate experience. What have you seen in your own kind of experience that is okay, this is what a good experience is, this is what a bad experience is. What are those things that make it obvious to you that that's the case? Can you give us two comments on that? Susan, let's go to you with this one first.
So two things that show that it's bad. One is what we call subpar. The definition of subpar, which is it's below the candidate's expectations. So if I apply for a job, I at least expect to get a response. So that's one way to tell that it's not working. Another way to tell that it's not working is that your candidate journey is just focused on the application process. So you're only collecting data, for example, on candidates who've applied for jobs. you're not looking broader at your talent pool, at the candidates that you'd love to attract, but have either never heard of you or will never consider you. And you don't know that because you're not getting any data from them.
Right. Fantastic. That's really, really good advice. I hope someone's making notes because I think this will be something that, you know, it could easily be a checklist for you. Okay, Coase, let's go with you. Give us some sort of things that you would say to a person who's wanting to get better at this, but they don't know what to do.
So I would say focus on hiring manager and posture during interviews. That's one highly correlating with the overall impact on candidate experience. Second would be feedback and follow up. So just make sure you get that proximity. If for whatever reason it's taking too long, your decision makers for a recruiting process are you know, needing to align with the half of the world and whatever, instead of, you know, not reaching out, just a text message, taking a bit longer, going to come back to you next week, just to keep that engagement going. Also, just if things are taking longer, you know, put in an intermediate, get to know a colleague thing. Just making sure it can take longer in time, but it's what happens within that time frame which will make all of the difference. And I think when you really nail down that, it's you're going to get happier candidates. And with happier candidates, Branson showed it in the really epic case of candidate experience and the value that it has for business. Because if you're consumer fronting business like Danone is, you actually can see, you know, the drop off in clientele. And of course, with a people centric business and everything we're doing, we want to make sure that reputation stays intact. So I would say hiring manager, interactions, and if you can't hire, you know, if you want to unload the workload, do hire a little bit extra, or even better, if you're spending all your days as a recruiter scheduling interviews, make sure you redirect that workload a little bit differently. Maybe the assistants of the directors can take a role or whatever, but you need to be in the human-to-human business. You don't want to be scheduling interviews and doing admin role. You need to, you know, be spending your time where you actually can have an impact on a human being.
Yeah, fantastic. By the way, I particularly love the idea of doing kind of an interim interaction, because as you say, maybe not the absolute length of time, it's the gaps in between events that cause people stress. Like when there's ambiguous moments, the person doesn't know whether they're going forward or not. That's when you need to intercede. You can't have that being a long stretch of time. Tim, let's go to you quick. Final answer. As you're on this journey, I don't expect any expertise, by the way, but yeah. What are your intuitions and what are your thoughts about what it is that you think a person that is about to embark also on something like this, what do they need to bear in mind and about the candidate journey?
So my takeaway and something that I learned early on when I started at Millicom is don't forget about the internal candidate journey. Internal candidates, and I'll end it with a quick story. A senior leader over here had just joined. He was involved in an interview process and interviewing multiple internal candidates. And something that I had seen from, I guess, one of the big consulting firms, and they had done work with, you know, they were looking at us, and they said one of the biggest complaints our employees had was not receiving feedback in an interview process. And this was something that stuck in my mind. So I specifically started training people and telling people it's very important that we in recruiting, we start making sure that our hiring managers are especially giving feedback to our internal candidates. So with this very senior individual, he told me, I have never given feedback to an internal candidate before. When people weren't selected, we just said, we're not moving forward. And I said, do me the favor, give your internal candidates feedback. And I ensured and I followed up. I met this individual on a work trip before COVID, and we were having dinner, and he said, Tim, you have no idea how I was blindsided, and I didn't realize how important this was, doing this. And by giving the internal candidate feedback, the internal candidate said, this is the first time I've even myself received feedback from a hiring manager. So for me, my takeaway is don't forget about the internal candidate experience, the internal candidate journey. Similar to what Coase was saying, the piece about feedback and follow-up is important. Even as a recruiter, even myself, when I do executive recruiting, I will send a note saying it's still in the review, I'll get back to you. And I ensure that I commit to my word. I set up a tracker. I set up a follow-up on myself to make sure that we give people feedback, especially treat your internals. We do about 40% of our hiring from internal applicant pools. So it's very important that you start thinking about it and you start looking at that. So that's my takeaway or giveaway.
Amazing. Tim, thank you very much. And Coz and Susan, thank you too very much as well. I mean, I think all of you could have said a lot more and actually listed a lot more things down as well, which would have been, I think the audience would have loved to hear it. But unfortunately, time is not allowing us to continue with that. So we have to end the show here, folks. So let me say goodbye to our guests. Susan, great to see you again. Hopefully we'll find the time to talk again at some point. Coz, enjoy the rest of your day. It looks like you know, there's a bed there. Go and take a nap. I think that's the right thing to do.
It's beer o'clock indeed.
Tim, great to see you, man. And hopefully we'll talk again soon. All of you, welcome back to Brain Food Live, of course. Have a good weekend.
Cheers, everyone. Thank you.
Wasn't that a great show? That was a great show. I enjoyed it. And by the way, I'm bleeding time massively. We're well over, so we all got to go. I get it. But I just want to say thank you to everyone who joined that. I thought that was excellent. And there's more to talk about. Obviously, every topic we have is like too big to squeeze into 1 hour. That's clear. But it gives us more food to talk about next time around. There's already some ideas bubbling away in terms of what we could be doing for next year, which we've got to start planning, by the way, because we're close to December. Once that's in, then, you know, really around the corner. Anyway, that's about it. Adam, what are you doing this weekend? Anything interesting?
I'm going to go to the gym as much as I possibly can. And that's...
Holly's had a word with you, right? Someone's had a word with you. Which I don't want to shame you. It's absolutely correct. Everyone's got to get in shape. You can't be losing it at this point. Totally right. Totally right. In fact, you should get your fitness in pre-Christmas because you know you're going to put on 10, 15 pounds anyway. Do you know what I mean?
You might as well
get started now. You know what I mean? Get started now.
Well, look, I eat like it's Christmas all year round. So that's the problem I need to fix.
Yeah, that's it. All right, listen, that's it. Have a good weekend. By the way, next week we are talking about recruiters switching industries. So if you're working in an industry vertical and you're thinking, oh, I don't like where that's going, you want to shift to something else, that is what we're talking about. Staying within recruiting, but shifting from, oh, I'm a tech recruiter, now you're recruiting for medical. Or I'm a retail recruiter and you're thinking, you know what, I don't fancy this market. I want to do data science. How do I do that? That's what we're talking about. So if you're in recruiting and you want to kind of flip, we're going to speak to people who've made that flip and they're going to educate us as to how you do that quickly. You about to say something?
Yeah, I tell you what, if I wanted to be a recruiter today, then see being a recruiter in like cryptocurrencies, that would be where I'd go. All the adverts, you should see them all on LinkedIn looking for people with, you know, 15 years experience in cryptocurrency and stuff like that.
It's the year of crypto. Shall we just check how Bitcoin is doing? Even Bitcoin these days is no longer cachet. It's been crashed, I think. It's still not far away. I mean, it's still 45,000 UK pounds for one Bitcoin.
Would you take your sponsorship? Your sponsors? Would you take sponsorship in cryptocurrency? In Bitcoin?
Sure. I mean, I was actually one of the very first businesses to accept Bitcoin. This is even pre-Brainfood, pre-Workshape. My old consultancy used to sort of, let's give me some Bitcoin. No one actually did it. If they did at the time, it was like 100 quid for one Bitcoin. I'd be like minted by now.
What about non-fungible tokens, NFTs?
I'm not sure about them, to be honest with you. I totally get the concept, but I actually don't like, for me, art needs to be something nice. And something I'd like to have. And I haven't seen too much that it's a lot of it's just chummed out. And it's why would I actually have this? So I'm not entirely convinced about it. But I'm a believer in the entire kind of Web3 is probably the right way to describe it. And there's lots of interesting technologies in recruiting and in kind of the idea of organizing labor that we need to keep an eye on. So that will be a topic I'm sure we'll discuss next year as well. All right, that's about it. I got to do stuff. So have a good weekend, everybody. Hope you've had a good time. Follow the channel if you've enjoyed this conversation. We'll see you next Friday.